Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, can technology help mitigate the environmental crises societies are creating? How much can they help? And first, violent policing and disappearing people is continuing in Brazil, even today in 2025. How is Brazilian civil society responding? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. In the 1970s and 80s, Brazil was governed by a military junta. Human rights abuses marked the government, and one in particular was the forced disappearances of critics of the state at the hands of the government. The country made disappear an action verb, as in a person was disappeared. This was similar to other nations in the region, Chile, Argentina, Paraguay. And Brazilians protested these disappearances with photographs of the disappeared and demanded to know where they were or a confirmation of their deaths. In Argentina, these were the mothers of the Plaza. Brazil had very similar types of protests. Brazil is a democracy in 2025, but people are still being disappeared. They are being arrested and disappearing in the prison system. So once again, Brazilians protests. And the protests have brought some results. On today's show, we'll examine this issue on how memory discourses are advanced and contested in the world. A note, this show was recorded on Thursday, October 30th, 2025. Erica Resende is an assistant professor of international relations and security studies at the Brazilian National War College in Rio de Janeiro. She's the co-author with Isadora Javier de Monte of a chapter entitled Speaking for the Dead in Brazil, Mothers as Memory Activists for Justice and Change. She's also the co-editor of the book the chapter is in. It's called Defending Memory in Global Politics, Mnemonical Insecurity and Crisis. Dovile Boudrit is one of the other co-editors, and for the record, I am the other. So, Erica, thank you so much for joining us. First of all, can you describe the issue and the nature of the protests that have been taking place in Brazil that compelled you to write that chapter?
So, one of the reasons why I wanted to write about this case, one has to do with how the empirics of this case talked about some literature gaps. So it allowed me to reach into what I perceived as a standing literature gap in the studies of memory activists and memory politics. And second, because I think it's a beautiful case that shows how disfranchised women from very poor peripheral areas still are able to resist, to be and regain and get political agency over very serious and far-reaching impact problems that we experience in Brazil to this day. Because although the military rule has finished in 85, there are some issues regarding especially the militarization of police in Brazil that continues to impact especially poor populations in the outskirts of the big cities in Brazil. So this is an issue or a case that allowed me to talk about how disfranchised, Black, poor, with almost none academic training or even illiterate women were able to raise their voices against problems that had to do with they being recognized as social actors, as political actors that are actually able to fight back and defend the memory of their loved ones.
And what's striking about this case, again, with the similarities between, you know, people literally being disappeared in Brazil's prison system and what was going on during the military government. Because there's kind of a sense that, I mean, it's not a military government. It's a democracy. It's recognized as, you know, democratically elected. But the same processes are taking place. I mean, is that a fair description to say the same disappearances that happened under the military are also now happening under this democracy?
Yes, I think the argument here is that although the military went away, the practice that they not only it's not that they innovated, because actually there's a persistence that dates back from the colonial times, but the military rule expanded some of the practices. And one of them has to do with death squads and the disappearances, the political disappearances. So I think it's very fair to argue that despite the change in regime, those practices are still there and they have to be fought and resisted. And that takes me to what that I think it's absolutely mandatory for me to mention, what happened yesterday in Rio de Janeiro, which produced 120 deaths in a slum area, in a favela, because again, our police forces, they are highly militarized. They think, act, train, and still continue to enforce policies that have not understood that we're living in democratic times. Police forces is there to serve the citizen, not to repress them, not to produce order, and by trying to do that, violate civil and human rights.
Now, a big chunk of the case that you wrote about took place under a more sort of authoritarian government than the previous president, Jair Bolsonaro, kind of known as much more authoritarian. But this case you're talking about, literally yesterday, Brazil is not only democratically elected, but they have who's generally perceived to be a much more progressive leftist president. And it seems like the practices haven't really changed. Who's the president doesn't seem to matter as much. Is that fair to say?
Yes, it is, because although we have elected once again Lula da Silva as a president, he's from the Labor Party. I wouldn't say that he's like a left wing, although he's by some accused of, but progressive, yes, but not at all left wing or extreme left. But what happened here in Brazil, and I think that has much to do or can be understood in terms of our colonial past, is the citizen is constructed by the state apparatus as someone that needs to be put under a tutelage because they are uncivilized, has no autonomy, is too naive, it's archaic. So the citizen is understood and constructed as someone that has to be put under order. So the notion of order is understood as having more priority over, for example, civil rights. So the notion that the citizen is someone that lives or die under a political consideration that the production of order for the state, development for the state, and needs to be put in a tutelage. So during the imperial times, it's tutelage by, the ancient elites, then the military rule by the military, now by conservative forces or politicians that they think they know best. And therefore, citizens are always understood as a potential threats to the state, threats to development, threats to order. And especially when those citizens are mostly brown, black, or mixed bodies.
And so the similarities between the way the government views the citizens, the question of policing between a democratic Brazil and a military authoritarian junta Brazil, you've highlighted those similarities. How similar were the protests against the disappearance of people at the hands of the police? In what ways was this most recent wave of protests similar to what was taking during the 60s, 70s, early 80s, and in what ways were there some differences?
I wouldn't talk about how to protest, but just how to be a citizen, how the being of a citizen. the good citizen, the notion that good citizens will not protest or will not take on the streets to articulate their demands. So the notion of a good citizen, and I think the similarities here again takes us back to colonial times, is a citizen that has to be more a passive object of state regulation and enforcement than rather someone with autonomy and be able to be politically. So the notion that if the crowds take on the street, the crowds need to be controlled. The masses, they don't know actually what they're doing or they want. They are manipulated. And even though now in democratic regimes is the notion that a police is there to protect property and to control the masses, especially if those masses come from outskirts, periphery, poor neighborhoods. So there's this, it's a two distinctive way of who can be politically. If it's from rich neighborhoods, white, more with a better position in society, or those who cannot because they are poor, they are black, brown, or intermixed, and they are located and have to be contained in the outskirts. So the distinguished, I think there's a continuity between military regime and democratic times. So our police continue to be very violent, very racially orientated, and very much militarized. And I think this is also a key concept to think about, not only the case of the mothers against, you know, police violence, but again, like it happened yesterday, the police forces in Brazil, they were created, established, and remodeled after the armed forces model. What does this mean? Police is not there to serve, but it's there to control, to impose by force, to impose order. So what happened is that our police apparatus are very militarized. They employ a very violent practice of crowd controlling. They employ a very racialized screening of who is a threat and who is not, and whose bodies are authorized to inhabit in certain places and be in certain places as opposed to others. And the whole notion that to impose order is more important than serve the citizen.
And you listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about police practices, protests against police practices, and the similarities in this process of disappearing individuals under 2025 Democratic Brazil, and those similarities to Brazil's authoritarian military government past. Our guest today is Erica Resende, and she's from the Brazilian National War College. So the violence yesterday reminds us that Brazil is still facing this issue about violence and control from policing. But what levels of resistance has there been? I'm reminded, of course, here in the United States, we're facing some potentially similar issues about the deployment of not just the police, but the military and some militarized responses. But there's at least been some forms of resistance in the U.S. In what ways has Brazil resisted?
So historically, dating from the military regime, one of the cases that I explore in this book chapter is the movement that is called the Mothers of Acari. Who are they? And what exactly were they resisting and protesting against? So in the late 60s, early 70s, especially in the outskirts of the big Brazilian cities like Rio de Janeiro, there were the phenomenon that we call death squads. What are those death squads? Groups of people that some of them were military, some of them reformed or retired ones, some of them were in active duty for the police forces, or similar branches of first responder, like the plumbers or firemen or things like that. But they all share the notion that they had to bring the masses under control, the notion of imposing order, and imposing order on bodies that are not full citizens. So they impose orders not in the rich neighborhoods of Rio de Janeiro, but rather in the outskirts and the favelas, so bodies that wouldn't matter. So there is a logic of necropolitics were at work here. And the death squads became a very, unfortunately, a very reoccurring thing, especially when those police officers, even some retired, they wanted to get even, do anything that specifically, for example, one day that would have like a police raid and a police officer would get shot or and die. So this group, it's a again, it's a clandestine group. They would get together, okay, let's take on the streets tomorrow evening at night. We'll go out unmasked with no identifications. And they go out in the night and disappear and grab people that they think are criminals, suspects, and they disappeared. They never return. Or even they are shot and the bodies were there to give out a message to the area that any misbehaving would be, would receive the proper punishment by those death squads. And so this was a phenomenon that really went on for in the outskirts, not only in Rio, but big cities like São Paulo in the north, northeast side. What happened then in this particular case that I explore in the book, over a weekend, there were some youngster and young people, I mean teenagers, that they gathered in a place for a barbecue by the pool, something like that, but again in the outskirts. And all of a sudden, there was a group of like around 15 people, families, and people that presented themselves as police officers, but bearing no identifications. Not for them, they were not wearing uniforms and did not have identifiable police vehicles. They don't show up and starting asking questions regarding the killing of a police officer like the previous week. And all of us, and they took away this group of teenagers and two adults and took them away, saying that they were taking them to a precinct for getting their statements. And this group of people never were seen again. So what happened in the following years is that the mothers and some of the mothers and sisters of those who were taken away, those disappeared, they started asking questions. They went to the precincts, to every precinct in the area. I'm looking for my father, I'm looking for my husband or my son. They were taken away. Where are my children, my cousins or nephew? And started asking very uncomfortable questions. And started denouncing that group of teenagers and two adults were taken, never to be seen again. And then working around this very basic notion of a mother has the right to know what happened to her son, to her daughter, or to her husband, started having questions. I have the right to reclaim a body. I have a right to know, to mourn, to know what happened to a loved one. And I am not going to accept the general, and back then, the practice of they just disappeared. There's no body, there's no crime. And they pushed and pushed and pushed for answers. They pushed for formal investigations by the Department of Justice, the correspondent of the Department of Justice in Brazil. They also pushed for the case to be heard and taken by the press. They pushed for a formal acknowledgement that was actually a death, although the bodies were never found. And they did not accept, took years, but even so, when they came, death certificates assigned to their loved ones, saying that they just disappeared, were declared and dead. No, they were not disappeared. They were actually killed, and killed by state agents. And that's pretty much sums up a struggle, almost a 30-year something struggle of those mothers. The leader of the group was eventually killed in an ambush by a death squad. And the leader of the group could not even know how to write her own name.
Okay, so with this case, since the state was indicating that people just disappeared, but of course activists wanted acknowledgement that the state had killed them, having accurate death certificates was really an essential request, an essential demand with respect to the protesters. What's the status of that right now?
Yes, the issue of the certificates became something, I think, central to the political events. So it's not only just a formal document saying that they disappeared, legally declared dead. And from that, you could, for example, ask for social benefits, stuff like that. No, the group Matavakari, they, from the first moment, and not only the death certificates, but the death certificates that stated that the loved ones were killed by police agents, state agents, that they were murdered. So the framing, and not just leaving as, you know, disappearance, was key to the construction of not only the political demand, but the identity of themselves, of the mothers of Akari. The notion that the state has to be made accountable, responsible for those deaths. Those deaths could not just be written off as people just disappearing on the street. And from that, the acknowledgement that they were victims and not potential criminals engaged in criminal activities. And that it was a 20, almost 30-something years struggle. What I think is, if you think about, oh, they were successful. Yes, they were indeed. In a very broad spectrum of achievements. One of them is not only the reissue of death certificates, but the state, the city council where the, you know, the disappearance or where the death squad was active in, were made to create a day, a city date, dedicated to the remembrance of those who are falling victims of police violence. So this is a one day in the year where the schools, for example, in the public system, they have to talk about police victims and police violence. At the same time, the creation of a city and state holiday for the remembrance of the disappeared from Akari. And finally, and this happened just at the end of last year, like 2 weeks after the book came out. So unfortunately, it's not something that I could update the book. But Brazil was eventually condemned at the Human Rights Court, the Inter-American Human Rights Court, for its negligence and not being, or not pursuing actively, the not only the investigation of the case, and as well not pursuing the formal prosecution of those involved and that participated in the death squad. So Brazil was condemned. That translated into not only a financial payment to all the families involved, but the formal acknowledgement that the Brazilian state apparatus and police apparatus was still very highly militarized, even though the military regime fell. So the courts issue a list of recommendations for police reform, and with the notion that the memory, the day of remembrance of police victims had to be brought up, not only as something to do in schools, but with a formal, every year, a formal ceremony at city council as an acknowledgement and not to forget what happened with the disappearance in Acari. So that case was very important because the whole hearing of the case happened during the Bolsonaro presidency. Bolsonaro actually actively tried to blockade the course of the litigation there, the human rights, the Inter-American Human Rights Court. For example, one attempt was to call and to recall its representatives so that the hearings could not happen, but they did happen in any way. At the same time, a resistance, or especially the framing of the movement of women, Black, poor, illiterate women, men, women of Acari, as being only interesting in benefiting financially from the case. So trying to, they struggle for that, or they want to, because they just wanted the penalties and the financial benefits that it would gain.
So they were just doing it for the money is what the argument is.
Yeah, that's what back then during Bolsonaro, they were just doing for the money.
So it seems like with this case, I mean, at one level, because there's been an acknowledgement, because there's been a payment, and because there is a remembrance, that at one level, memory activism and the memory of this type of violence, you know, was successful. And so we can celebrate that. But a reminder that if the reason why memory is so important is to change behavior and to stop these practices, well, yesterday, today is Thursday the 30th. So yesterday on October 29th, there were murders as a result of policing of marginalized people, people of color, et cetera, which suggests that maybe the most important thing about memory, let's make sure this doesn't happen again. That hasn't been terribly successful. So last quick question. Are you optimistic or pessimistic that this case, these remembrances, are going to actually change Brazilian policy?
I'm not terribly optimistic vis-a-vis Brazilian state policies, but I am optimistic vis-a-vis Brazilian civil society policies, so to speak. I think it has to do with us, rather than the state, to try to have, just to keep in mind why it's important to never forget, né? Nunca mais, which is also a motto not only of Mother of Acari's, but the whole resistance movement dating from military rules in South America, the never forget. So, for example, that's why I was so happy, and actually I even cried when I received the news that Brazil won the Oscar, the Academy Award Oscar on Best International Film, a film depicting a very similar case, the disappearance of a congressman in Brazil.
And the film's name is?
Oh my God, no, it's slipping
It's
my
I'm
mind.
Still Here in the
yeah,
English.
Yeah, the film is I'm Still Here. And
right.
It talks about the struggle of his widow, wife, that she would just not accept a formal response saying your husband just went out to get cigarettes and never came back. He disappeared. And her struggle, she even put herself through law school. And that's the final, the very almost final scene in the movie. How happy she was when she actually received the newly issued death certificate saying that her husband was killed by Brazilian state agents. So it's the notion that how death certificates, and especially in this context of be it disappearance due to military rule or police violence, but the notion that it's the formal acknowledgement, even if indirectly, of the state still needs to be held accountable and needs to recognize those deaths, and how important it is for the families to be able to mourn. I think the first step is to, you have to have an acknowledgement that there was a killing, there was a murder, there was just not, especially in a very conservative society as in Brazil, the notion that The woman is left behind. The man just can go out to get cigarettes and start another family or second family. So the burden of towards women is very disproportionate in Brazil. And for example, one thing is when you have a document say, no, my husband did not just go out for coffee and never came back. He was taken. He was murdered. By whom? The state. The state that should be and supposed to be there to protect and to defend rights, human rights. So the symbolic power of death certificates in those two instances, be it during the military regime or in democratic times, it shows it's important. And how Brazilian audiences went into almost a cathartic moment in that final scene. And the celebration of a death certificate was very moving. So that is what fuels my optimism in a sense.
Right. And on that, ironically, with this case, we're going to end on an optimistic note that even though these injustices continue and even though this violence continues, the truth will eventually, be known or be, be acknowledged. But most importantly, I think from all of this, the truth shall be revealed is a passive voice that seems that the truth just kind of comes out. Instead, it's important to remember the incredibly important role of activists, of protesters, of individuals who demand to know the truth. And it may take years, but protest and demands for the truth can be successful. We've been talking about policing in Brazil, the violence of policing, the ways in which policing, even in a democratic regime, mirror the policing under authoritarian regimes, certainly historically in Brazil. Our guest today has been Erica Resende. She is an assistant professor of international relations and security studies at the Brazilian War College. She's the co-author of a chapter with Isadora Javier de Monte. The chapter is called Speaking for the Dead in Brazil: Mothers as Memory Activists for Justice and Change. It's in the book called Defending Memory in Global Politics, Pneumonical Insecurity and Crisis. Erica's one of the editors. Deauville Boudrite is one of the co-editors, and I am the other one. Thank you so much, Erica, for sharing the story, for sharing your time, sharing your expertise with us and with our audience.
It was a pleasure, and I was very happy to be back on the show. I think this is my third participation, and I'm looking forward to the fourth one.
Oh, and there will be a fourth. So thank you. A note, this show was recorded on Thursday, October 30th, 2025.
When we come back, how might technologies help mitigate and adapt to climate change and other environmental crises? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. People around the world have developed innovative new technologies to mitigate or adapt to climate change. In many cases, adaptation has proved difficult, as governments and some large corporations have been reluctant to support them. Who are developing these tech solutions, and what are some of the technologies? Can they help protect us from the worst of climate change? With us is Holly Beals. She is a strategic director and senior innovation specialist, Aurora Climate Lab lead at CreativeHQ, one of the organizations working to advance these solutions. Also with us is Michael Fielding, chief executive officer of Auckland University of Technology Ventures, also a founder in the Aurora program. He seeks to turn research and expertise into real-world impact.
And it's such a great pleasure to be hosting you.
Kia ora. Thank you.
Kia ora, Maria.
I thought it might be good to kind of start with the context as you see it about the sustainability issues that we're trying to address and how we're going about trying to address them. Holly Bill, let's start with you.
Well, in climate tech, we're mainly dealing with the issues of how we handle carbon and the many ways that we can, I guess, reduce sources of carbon emissions, support drawdown opportunities for carbon and storing them permanently, and then improving our societies towards future systems and infrastructure that support that in ways that work for people.
So maybe we should talk about some of the ways that we're doing that, or that you and specifically are doing that. So you said drawing down, reducing, and then a system. What have you been developing so far in each of those areas?
At Creative HQ, which is where I am, I run a program named Aurora Climate Lab, and it's a climate tech accelerator for startups who have solutions for climate change related problems. So they might fall into any of those categories around solutions that help reduce sources of emissions or provide carbon drawdown and storage opportunities, or could be more in an adaptation space from a societal perspective, although we see kind of less of those initiatives coming through our program at the moment. We have a huge range of wonderful companies that come through our programs, and a lot of them are working with the future of energy. Some of them are working on future food, so how we handle issues of food production and agriculture. Some of the solutions are around the built environment, so carbon negative cement alternatives, for example. One of our teams in our recent program had some software for helping developers and architects measure the decarbonization opportunities as they are designing. So that's a software solution, but it's one that helps proactively manage carbon.
So can we talk about some of these that have come out so far? Like, so you mentioned, for example, the drawdown, the storage. It's a relatively expensive process, as I understand, but I could be way behind the times. So what has developed in that space? And how is it doing in relation to the massive kind of emissions that we're admitting?
Yeah, great question. I mean, I think there's changing technology and changing sentiments around carbon drawdown technologies, and it can be quite polarizing for people of different schools of thought. And this is to do with, you know, how much do we enable large emitters to continue doing what they're doing? I hold the philosophy, and we hold the philosophy here, of we need to do it all. So we need to be enabling industry to reduce emissions, as well as drawing down carbon, atmospheric carbon, where we have opportunities to do so and create new value out of waste. My approach is the multitude, and my philosophy is the multiple paths philosophy, but there are different schools of thought on this. Yeah.
What would you add?
Yeah,
Michael Fielding.
Thank you, Maria. Yeah, so I think fundamentally the problem has shifted. The understanding of the problem of sustainability has shifted over the last few decades. You know, originally back in, say, the 70s, 80s, probably persisting into the 90s, population growth was seen as the biggest issue. You know, we're going to have more people demanding more resources, and how are we going to cope with that? Now, you know, all the projections are saying that population growth will top out at, I don't know, you probably know better than me, but it's like 2050 or something. And the growth is plateauing. I think global population growth is less than 2% at the moment, 1% or something. But at the same time, wealth is growing. And that is a good thing. It's lifting more people out of poverty, but it means they consume more. So while the population isn't growing super high, you know, super fast, it's the consumption of goods shifting into more expensive, less environmentally friendly forms of protein, greater desire for consumer goods. So in the area that my startup works in, Dot Ingredients, which is the area of surfactants and emulsifiers. So these are used in everyday products. Anytime you're washing your hands, your dishes, your house, if you're putting on a skin cream or you're moisturizing, you're using makeup, they're used in agriculture. It's a $50 billion US dollar a year industry. And the growth in that industry is 6 times faster than global population growth. So what that means is there's actually quite a growth in that demand for these products. And they're 95% made from petrochemicals or palm oil, so fossil fuels or palm oil. And so the industry has to try and reduce those at the same time underlying growth, you know, is growing faster than population. So that's the real challenge is no longer that population is growing. You know, the end is in sight, you could say, for that. But we've got to find new ways of coping with increasing consumer demand. You're touching before on drawdown and reducing carbon. And in the sector of industrial chemicals, there's going to be a range of solutions, like Holly said. You know, there's going to be a lot of different solutions needed. You can always find some way, some new feedstock that's environmentally friendly. You could switch from fossil fuels to olive oil, for example. But the real challenge is always scale.
Yeah. Like, and then, of course, the climate conditions are making things like olive oil scarcer.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll probably be able to grow more of it in New Zealand, I guess.
I think that's right.
Hotter and drier, so we're well positioned there. But it's scale. In the sector we're in, it's a 20 megaton a year demand. And you cannot just switch off the fossil fuels and go, oh, let's use olive oil, you know, because that's got to come from somewhere. And that is not without its environmental consequences as well. It could be water. It's going to be energy. And it's very easy to say, you know, I'm going to set up this brand. We're going to use this type of material. I'm going to make a skin cream or something. And it's going to be environmentally friendly because it's not going to use palm oil. It's going to use coconut oil. Well, actually, coconut oil has about three times the land use, tropical land use, than palm oil. Mm. So it's probably not actually more environmentally friendly. You're also not doing it at an industrial scale. So yeah, you can find all of that coconut oil. But when you start scaling up to like a laundry powder, it just gets so much more difficult. So that's, I think, one of the big challenges with everything that you want to switch is finding that scale, finding something that's truly scalable.
So there are, for example, as you mentioned, and your own company is one of them, these alternatives that have claims of being more environmentally friendly. You know, they have the green labels, they have names that suggest they are more climate neutral, maybe not completely climate neutral, but a little less damaging. How do you know?
Yeah, so...
And what should they have in them? I mean, like, if somebody were going to turn the back of their product and say, well, I'd really like to be as climate neutral as I can be, what should they be looking for?
Yeah, look, I don't have the answer. I don't think there is one answer. I've seen companies pitching that they have carbon neutral, fossil fuel based surfactants or ingredients for some of these.
Is that possible?
Yeah, well, so what they use is carbon capture and sequestration. So,
oh, I see.
So they take the carbon from the production process and then they throw it underground.
Yeah. So would that be, so pardon my like challenging them. I know you're not defending them, but like, would that be just a limited amount of the production process or the entire process? Because those are two different things.
Yeah. And so you talk about, you know, scope one, scope two, and scope three emissions. And look, I'm not an expert in this area. I think it's very easy for companies to do some kind of hand waving about choosing the scope of what they include. As an example, a company that I've seen saying, you know, at a conference that they have carbon negative a palm oil base, so carbon negative palm oil. And the thing is that they stopped their box, if you like, around which they're considering to be carbon negative before the product actually biodegrades. Even a natural product, like say you take a palm oil or any sort of oil, you know, it's locked up that carbon up until the point it biodegrades. Now, you have to be biodegradable. I think we'd all agree that's a goal. It's actually a legal requirement, you know, a regulatory requirement to be biodegradable, which is a good thing. But at that point, it releases its carbon. So any carbon you've used in the production process is going to add to the carbon. Nothing's free.
Nothing is free. Yeah. That's actually one of the things I wanted to sort of talk with you two about, because, I mean, I love this solution-focused effort to turn to technology, turn to business, even government and NGOs, and we're all trying to come up with these solutions. But given the speed with which the change is occurring, how are we going to get there, Holly Beale?
It's really complex. And look, if it came down to technological solutions, we'd be there. I think, you know, there's enough technological opportunity being explored and being found that if it came down to technical solutions alone, we wouldn't be in the position we're in. It's as much about behavioral change, systemic change, corporate change. And this is a large focus that we bring to our climate lab is helping academics and technological experts become entrepreneurial in how they connect in with customers and markets and government and regulatory authorities to try to apply pressure on the right levers for systemic change, because so many of these solutions require new markets or emerging markets that don't exist yet.
So you had listed in your annual report 4 success stories in this area. Do you want to pick a couple of them?
Yeah. One of our teams in last year's program, Last Mile, had demand-side energy management tool, which they're bringing to market now and starting with schools in Taranaki and working with the Ministry of Education. So they are a company who have a plug-in solution that you can put in your home or put in your school to help your smart appliances talk to each other and manage the demand on the grid, while also plugging into lines companies and Transpower to help from an infrastructure grid management perspective to preempt your habits around power use and be able to manage demand more effectively across the grid. So it brings, power reduction and power bill benefits to a consumer. So their power bills can go down, but it also brings much more foresight from an infrastructure perspective back to the grid. They're a company who absolutely had a technological solution a long time ago, but without forming the strategic partnerships to get a system working together and connect in with those partners to create this effect, you know, the solution can't be realized. So that's Last Mile.
That's excellent.
Another company I'm going to talk about, Good Grub Agritech, also alumni from last year's Climate Lab. They have a solution for insect bioconversion of waste. This is something that can be utilized in citywide infrastructure eventually, but starting more on a smaller scale at first, providing a circular solution essentially for management of waste, turning this into FRAS or protein sources for aquaculture or pet food, and also minimizing the carbon emissions of the landfill, the waste that would otherwise go to landfill.
Let's check with Michael Fielding here too. And what are some of the innovations that you think are really important and effective at the moment?
I know of quite a lot of innovations in New Zealand that seem to be around the commodity chemicals area. And what is, I found really interesting over the last year is the shift in the pitch driven by the changes in the political landscape in the US in particular. So I think of Mint Innovation, they're launching a $100 million investment round, which is a pretty chunky round. And, you know, for those who aren't familiar with them, Mint Innovation takes e-waste, so phones, computers, that sort of thing, and they grind them up and they extract the critical minerals out of them. So, you know, when they started, this was an environmental thing. Let's not mine new chemicals. That uses a lot of chemicals in itself that often get left in the environment. It uses a lot of energy, so it's not great for the environment. But what they're now pitching is this is a solution to sovereign materials. Mm-hmm. So instead of mining materials out of country X, Y, or Z, you can reuse your own materials that you've already got in your old products and reuse them to reduce your dependence. And I've actually seen this in our sector in the surfactants and emulsifiers area as well. The Kaupapa, if you like, is no longer around just being environmentally friendly. That is actually taken as a given. And just to loop back to what you're asking before about how would customers know, I think that, you know, if you make buying choices and create demand for environmentally friendly products, you should possibly be less worried about the short-term decision of is this product better than that product. But by creating demand, these companies are trying to understand consumers all the time, not just in terms of sustainability, but when you create demand for environmentally friendly products, it filters all the way up to the board level that this is the products that we want to release. And so it's not a perfect solution. You cannot go to something and say, right, this is definitely more environmentally friendly than that. But if you choose to make buying decisions based on that sort of interest, then that creates demand. And the solutions will flow from that.
So how do you create demand?
Well, you use your wallet. Buy the products that are more environmentally
friendly. Are you talking about consumers creating the demand?
Consumers,
got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Choose products that claim to be green.
Yeah, that hopefully
talk
are.
About them. And that, hopefully are. You know, you've got some hope that the consumer marketing legislation is strong enough that that will mean that they are more environmentally friendly. Like I say, sometimes you can have many times. In fact, you can have unintended consequences. But the major manufacturers, certainly in the chemical space, are looking for new products. Sorry, new ingredients, new chemicals, new approaches to create the same chemicals. And as a starting point, because of the demand from the people who buy off them, and they're the ones who are making products for consumers, because of that demand, they're saying, right, it's going to have to be more environmentally friendly. It's not necessarily going to be perfect, but we've got to be moving in the right direction. Whereas 5 years ago, you know, let's introduce a new product that's more environmentally friendly. Now it's, right, when you need new products that are environmentally friendly, as long as they don't cost any more and as long as they perform as well. Yeah. So, you know, you used to have this triangle, you know, it's got to be more sustainable, it's got to be more cost effective, and it's got to perform well. And, you know, you choose any two of those. You know, that classic thing, you can have two out of these three options. Now, you really have to have all of them. And that's making things tougher. It is driving innovation, though. But if consumers stop demanding more sustainable ingredients because they're unsure about whether it really is or really isn't, then that's when these companies will go, well, obviously consumers don't even care about sustainability, so why should we?
Yeah. I love the idea that, you know, these old electronics that we used to just toss out are really gold mines. I mean, they're full of precious metals. And so to be able to extract all those metals really does affect the sustainability on multiple levels.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, if you had to design a product or a new ingredient or something, pretty much I would think most things that are reusing a waste are surely going to be more environmentally friendly than other things. You know, in the commodity chemicals area, even if you can create something from a crop like a palm oil or a coconut oil or a canola oil, what the industry is aiming for is land less, right? So how do we supply all the chemicals that we need but without using more land? Because we don't want to deforest more land. In fact, there are regulations. Of course, Europe has introduced the EU deforestation regulations. It's a little bit up in the air about how committed they are to sustaining that in the sense of keeping it around. Regulations essentially means that beyond the cutoff date, which is 31st of December, I want to say 2023, maybe it was 2024, that products imported into Europe cannot be made on land or have ingredients made on land that was deforested after that period of time. And so every company that's importing ingredients, commodities into Europe has to be able to prove that the land was deforested before that time. Pretty powerful regulation. Again, unintended consequences. It may mean that all of the older, long-existing crops now go to Europe and the rest of the world gets the newly deforested crop, or the crops grown on newly deforested
unless
land.
The rest of the world follows in their footsteps.
Yeah.
Which may or may not happen. I mean, there are treaties and that sort of a thing, and it's all, you know, it's the plastics one is happening right now. There's always the possibility that the world comes together, but you're right. I can see your face. You're not convinced.
Oh, no. So again, like, I've stopped being a perfectionist. You know, there's that expression that if you're not a rebel in your 20s, you've got no heart, and if you haven't turned establishment by 30, and I'm a little over 30 now, nothing is going to be perfect, but it will create demand for better use of land, or in fact not using land. And that's where we come back to, you know, anything that's using waste is generally going to be a good thing. But, you know, municipal food waste, a great resource of high nutrients and so on, but there's no system to, well, in most places, there's no system to collect that. It's highly variable, it's seasonal, it's subject to a huge amount of contamination. It's not perfect. But if we create demand for these products, then I'm really buoyed up by the billions of dollars in venture capital that has been put into solving problems like this. Well, they're only going to keep investing while we create demand for it.
So the idea of using waste, the circular economy, like not being a linear economy for, you know, people who aren't immersed in this terminology. So rather than extracting new, that we use the old over and over and over again, repurposed or refurbished or whatever that happens to be. How much can that continue? And kind of fuel the sustainable future. What do you think, Holly Beale?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's critical that our solutions become more circular, more regenerative, more, I mean, Michael was talking about this changing climate sentiment, and we can no longer charge a green premium for these solutions because it's expected. All three corners of that triangle need to be met. And part of that is that this changing sentiment that actually these solutions bring more security, energy security, onshoring of supply chains. And this is where our innovation comes in. Everything becomes less centralized, less globalized, and more regionally local. Yeah, and we really move away from terms, I guess, around sustainability and global warming and emphasizing these scary sentiments that maybe earlier eras of climate tech or clean tech focused around. So absolutely, I think the circular economy is fundamentally part of that.
And it can, as you say, it can be done locally. So I guess, I mean, given what we're facing already, you know, food insecurity, major weather events, at what speed do we have to innovate to really have the impact that we need? Any thoughts on that?
Again, I stopped being an idealist. You know, we've smashed through 1.5% with no end of growth in sight. And so I think the adaptation that you mentioned earlier, Holly, is also an important part of the solution. We have to be realistic, but we have to not give up.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us. It's just so wonderful to host you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks,
thank you very much for the opportunity to talk.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.